So yes, I am Jess McIver. I'm coming to you from UBC. So I am the deputy spokesperson for the LIGAR Scientific Collaboration. So if you have any questions about our results and I can share them with you, I'm very happy to do that. So since I'm sweeping through your lives just for today, here's some fun facts about me since we don't have that much of a chance to chat. I do attempt to play the euphonium. I am getting better. My performance is improving. Really like to be outside, and I really do mean this. If you want to reach out to me anytime after the school, please feel free to send me an email. I'll see if I can get these slides to you as well.
We will post those on the webpage too if you can send them to us.
Perfect, thank you very much. All right, so I wanted to take a moment to acknowledge that we're on the land of the Haudenosaunee people, who I learn a little bit more about every time that I come to Perimeter, which I really appreciate. I'm coming to you from the UBC campus. So here is this red line is showing this view of the Musqueam territory. The UBC campus is here, right on this beautiful peninsula. Triumph is just down the road here. And these four dots, one of them is probably so small you can't see it from the back of the room. This is the territory that the Musqueam people currently inhabit. So I got the really good advice for land acknowledgements to put something actionable in it. So I put something that's meaningful to me, with Vancouver housing prices being what they are, which is the Aboriginal Housing Management Association. So if you are living in Vancouver or going to Triumph or otherwise find this meaningful and you like, you can endorse their housing plan. But I encourage you to think about the land that you live or work on if you're working in Canada or the US, and find something meaningful to you to act on. All right, so with that, I wanted to say, don't get too comfortable today. So we've got 4.5 hours of gravitational wave experiment. So what I'd like us to do is every time that we change a topic, I would like you to stand up if you'd like. If you want to stay where you are, that's also okay. But I would encourage you to stand up and find 3 to 4 people that you haven't spoken with a lot yet during the school. And there are a couple different reasons I want to do this. One is because, again, 4.5 hours, it's good to break this up. But the second one that's even more important is that I think a lot of the connections you make with your fellow students are going to follow you in your career. They can be really important. So I still speak with summer school students that I met 10 or more years ago, and we're regular collaborators now. So let's try and maximize that opportunity. And let's get some practice with this now. So please find 3 or 4 people that you haven't spent a lot of time talking to, introduce yourselves, share your pronouns if you'd like, and maybe 1 or 2 fun facts. And we'll take a few minutes to do this. And we're gonna do this at least a few times today. So let's take a minute to find some new colleagues. Is what email? Oh yeah, that's my real email.
Because you never answer.
That's true. You know, that can happen if I'm
several
traveling.
Things I emailed you.
Yeah.
I wanted to invite you for my question.
That's right.
But you didn't reply at all.
Yeah, I was. What was happening at that time? Yeah, please. The trick to me is that if I'm saturated and you wait for like a week or two and you bump me up again, you'll have a much better shot. So today, for example, I'm not answering any emails. Today's no email day. Yeah. Good to see you. Hi. We're doing an icebreaker.
What is that one? This is.
UBC. I'm an aspirational Canadian. I'm originally American. Oh, it's beautiful.
So you know, Scott.
Yes. Oh, very good. Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's very bad. It's very, very bad.
You've been there for very long?
No, I just arrived just before COVID.
So you're only just getting to know people.
Exactly. People, places, yeah. I still feel like I'm learning.
So are you on my grad?
That's right. Yeah. Yes. All right, I think I'm going to reconvene us here. We'll get more of a chance to chat. All right. But before you break your groups up, so we have your first challenge as a team. So you should do this as a team. Please come up with a couple topics that you are most interested to hear about today. And we're going to list these on the board. So let's take another few minutes and talk with your colleagues. What are you excited about for gravitational wave experiments? Is there anything that you'd really like us to cover today? So I can't promise that we will, given that I'll only have maybe maximum an hour or two to change my lectures for later in the afternoon, but I'd really like to steer us in the directions that you'd most like to go. So let's take another few minutes, have that discussion. Are there any topics that you're particularly interested in hearing about today? Yeah. If I can do it, I will, and if I can't, then I won't. I have a little bit of that in there. I'm not involved in nanograph, but... interested in hearing about here?
Yes. Well, I'm actually very interested. I would like to work on my PhD on gravitational waves.
Amazing.
And yes, and well, I'm actually interested about knowing how gravitational waves can we understand better the strong field limit in gravity, you know,
Ooh.
And maybe
absolutely
try to push forward into general relativity to find corrections and something like that. So,
amazing.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you're going to hear a lot about that next week, actually, when you meet Luis.
Yeah, I'm very excited about this kid.
Yeah. Oh, me too. He's a great teacher.
I also wanted to maybe learn about how LIGO really does what it does. Like, I feel like I know what it does in general, but it's precise to a limit that I really cannot think about. But so, like, how the instrument is.
Gotcha. Okay, we will cover that.
Okay.
How about you?
I don't have much idea about what they will be covering. I know a little bit about the LIGO experiment, but I don't know much about other.
Aha! So, okay.
Maybe also care more about other experiments in this type of thing.
Okay. So this is Lisa, this is, you mean ground-based, so LIGO and friends, and part of the friends, or do you mean more other boundaries?
More different types
of. Okay, yeah, we'll spend a lot of time on Lisa, which I think is really exciting. Okay, very nice, thank you for chatting.
Thank you.
All right, I hope that you have some time to chat. So I've heard some really nice ideas over here from this side of the room. Would anybody like to share an idea or two, a topic that you'd really like to hear about? Yes?
Yeah, whatever nanograph is going
to. Okay, I'm gonna say secrets. So I can't actually tell you any secrets, but I can tell you a projection. I can tell you what members of Nanograph thought that they would see in 2023. So we can talk about that, very nice. Yes, other ideas? What are other things people want to hear about? Yes?
Maybe this is a bit involved, but I was working with gravitational waves in MSDAS, and there's this parameter called tidal deformability. Mm-hmm. And somehow LIGO put constraints on that, but I really don't know what it is actually. So I used the constraints, but I don't really know what it is.
Okay, very nice.
Yeah.
We are already planning to get an intuitive sense of tidal deformability. I may consult with Luis to see what he's covering. So you'll hear more of the theory aspect of gravitational wave generation, and we'll see if we can get you some overlap. All right, but very good. Tidal deformability. So I'm going to use a lambda for this, and hopefully future me will remember that lambda is tidal deformability. All right, I saw another hand up. Yes?
Yeah, I would like to know two things with more precision. First, how do PTAs really extract information?
Ooh. Okay.
The second thing, more precisely, how do phase transitions generate gravitational waves? Like, how do we do computations with them?
Okay, I'm going to make a Luis column. This will be homework for Luis. Phase transitions. Yeah, so not everything we will get to today. So we're just going to take what we need from the theory of gravitational wave generation to understand the experiment, and you'll hear a lot more about the theory from Luis next week. But I'll let him know that there's interest in phase transitions, and I think he'll have fun with that. Yes?
I'm interested in how squeezing works and how you use it in LIGO.
Okay, very good. We can talk about squeezing. Who here has heard of light squeezing? Okay, a few of us. All right, it's really exciting. It's very cool. We don't have time to treat it as much more than black magic that we understand the output of. This would be 2 days of algebra on the blackboard, lots of annihilation and creation operators to really understand it in a theoretical way, but I can definitely point you to a good PhD thesis that walks through it. But we'll get an intuitive understanding of squeezing and how we use it and what it does. All right, yes?
I was interested in the tensor to scalar ratio.
Tensor to scalar ratio. Okay, I may put that in the Luis column. We're going to take a little bit of essentially what we need from polarizations. Oh, no. So we were using Microsoft Teams for the CAP Congress. This is the only way for speakers to project their slides. And ever since I've downloaded it, nothing but problems. Okay, I'm sorry. Scalar to tensor ratio. Okay, I'm going to put this in the Luis column for now. And yeah, let's maybe come back after the first lecture and see if we want to refine the direction a little bit, and I can coordinate with Luis on that. Very good. Yes?
Yeah, can gravitational wave move faster than the speed of light?
Ooh, okay.
Or so.
Yes? And I'm going to expect that we're not going to finish this, so I'll sweep that over there. I think I saw a hand up down here. Yes?
I'll ask for this front. What do we know about the black hole mass gaps?
Ooh, okay, mass gaps. Very good. So I know a lot more about this from the observational perspective than I do about the population modeling. Why do you expect to have a mass gap angle? So we can comment that from that angle. Very good.
So you still have some Lisa hype at the end?
Oh, yes. We're going to spend a lot of time on Lisa. I will reserve a lot of time for Lisa. I'm going to give it an exclamation point so I don't forget. Most of our last lecture will be Lisa. Yes?
Love numbers, whatever that is.
Okay. We're going to do that with tidal deformability.
Okay.
Yes. And I have some wonderful nuclear physics colleagues that know a lot more about this than I do that I will probably point you to. But yes, we can talk about that just a little bit. Yes?
The detectors, except for interferometer detectors, are there any other common ones?
You mean like atom interferometry or that kind of thing? Okay. I have so far zero slides prepared on this, so we'll see how we do, but aspirationally, I'm going to write this down. Other detectors. Very good. Okay. Yes?
I would always like to hear in a very systematic way about the sources of error, I mean, in experiment. What are the challenges? Like, I mean, airspace, like 1,000 meters, or what are the similar things that we have for LISA?
Right. We are going to talk a bit about, I call them challenges as well. This is actually my specialty in the collaboration, sources of noise and challenges. So if I start talking about this, there's some chance that I won't stop and we won't make it to LISA, but I have some nice stories for you that I think are interesting. Okay, very good. Yes?
Connected with LISA, maybe astrophysical stochastic background, VS, primordial stochastic background, like what
okay.
Can we distinguish?
Yes, I think the generation of stochastic background will be firmly in Luis territory.
Luis is going to be very busy.
Yes. Happily for us, I think Luis is probably already planning on covering that. Okay, so stochastic background. Very good. All right. Any other topics that people are really keen to see today? Yes?
Well, this is related to the challenges thing, is that you hear that the position of the mirror is being determined to within the size of a nucleus. So can you help us understand how that can be possible?
Okay, yes. Let's see, how to best characterize that. Maybe I'll say a skeptical, really? And yeah, let's dig into that. Yes?
This might be also more of a Luis thing, but the measurement of gravitational memory effects.
Ooh, yes. I can speculate about that in my own words. I'll write that down here. Yeah, is memory detectable? All right, and I've run out of space on my column of the board here, but is there anything else anybody really wants to hear about? Yes?
The role of gravitational waves in this multi-messenger approach.
Ah, okay. Very good. I'm going to write that at the top. Multi-messenger astronomy. Yes. Very nice. Okay, yes?
Having a problem is disentangling lots of overlapping signals, especially for LISA.
Okay, yeah, I was actually about to write that down for LISA. Okay. Yeah, the LISA community chooses not to see this as a problem or as like an opportunity. It's a signal-rich source of data. All right, any others before we go forward? Yes?
I just wanted to add a plus one to really.
Okay. All right, we really want to hear about really. Very good. All right, so let us forge ahead and we can take stock of how we're doing by the end of the day and see if there's anything else that we want to make sure that we hit on. I'm going to find my slides again, if Teams lets me escape. Uh-oh. Okay, there we go. Okay, so I wanted to start with a fun fact. So, you may have heard the term gravitational wave. That might now be in your vocabulary. So, sometimes we'll hear people say gravity wave, and you might think, well, that sounds great. It's two syllables fewer, and it's really pretty clear what I mean in context. So I wanted to give you some backgrounds on why you'll never see gravity wave in a textbook or a conference title, why the community usually sticks to the full five-syllable gravitational. So the context here is that gravity waves is a very common term that's been used for decades by weather scientists. So usually when they say gravity waves, they mean gravity, so that's the restoring force between two surfaces. So this could be the surface of water and the atmosphere, this could be two layers of the atmosphere. So if you've ever seen a cloud pattern like this, a weather scientist would call that a gravity wave pattern. And similarly, yes, ocean waves, lake waves. So we've got a couple examples of what I would call gravity waves, and then one example of what I would call a gravitational wave. You can choose to use any terminology that you like, but now you are experts and you've been firmly indoctrinated in the full five-syllable mouthful that we write out in all of our papers and talk titles and conference titles. This is why our titles are so long. All right, so today we're going to loosely be following a paper in contemporary physics that I put together with David Shoemaker at MIT. I also have these links that you'll be able to find in the slide to Sathya Prakash and Schitt's Living Review in Relativity, where we're also going to grab a bunch of figures from that too. It's a wonderful resource. We'll also follow Cole Miller's notes on gravitation and radiation a bit. And again, we're just going to grab the theory that we need to understand the experiment. You're just going to see it in snapshots, bits and pieces. We'll get some intuition for what motivates building the experiment the way that we did. And then I've left Luis with a few things for you to cover next week. All right, so if you don't already have one out, we are going to do some quick calculations together. So you may want to grab a paper, pen, or pencil, or make friends with someone who has a paper or pen handy, or a tablet, or a maybe Mathematica, whatever your favorite method is. And here is going to be our approach for the next, it's almost been half an hour, so the next 4 or so hours with some breaks for other science and lunch, etc. All right, so we're going to talk about what are gravitational waves. So, and again, we're just going to cover the emission and source theory that we need in order to proceed to understand these experiments. And in doing that, we're going to derive and estimate some orders of magnitude that are going to motivate what we're doing a little bit later on. We are going to cover a lot of data analysis. So how do we find these things? And this is actually going to answer some of the questions that we're most interested in. How do we deal with overlapping sources? How do we deal with these sources of noise and other challenges? How do we best leverage this data that's full of gravitational waves with future detectors? Of course, we're going to cover interferometers. That's what I mean when I say detector is an interferometer. So I come from the LIGO sphere. Of course, there are other methods, especially pulsar timing, and we'll close with that today, just a little snippet of their projected detections. And then I want to cover what have we learned so far, and ideally, what else could we learn? If we build these future experiments, where are we going to be in the coming decades? And then we'll get to the big picture and our excellent point about multi-messenger astronomy. All right, so that's the plan. I am going to predict that we'll, in practice, maybe cover 2/3 of this. So please feel free to steer the discussion as we go to make sure that we're maximizing what we want to hear about. All right, so gravitational emission. So the emission of gravitational waves is really nicely captured by this formula for strain. So you're going to hear, you're going to derive this very likely next week, but I, for now, have said GR happens. We started with a flat Minkowski metric. We introduced a perturbation. We made some assumptions about what kind of space we were working with. And we ended up with a wave solution. And what we see here is this direct prediction for strain. This is a function of time. And it depends on this quadrupole moment. And now, just in case you're not already familiar with quadrupole moment, what exactly does that mean? So this is describing this asymmetric, aspherical asymmetry. So we've got a few different ways this can manifest. So this is projected into different axes in a three-dimensional coordinate system. But this is telling us if you have some kind of asymmetry that breaks spherical symmetry and that system is accelerating. So this is another thing to notice about this term here. So this is the second time derivative of this term. This is what's directly proportional to this we call strain. So this is going to be the stretching and squeezing of space-time that we're actually able to measure. So we've got this amplitude as a function of time. This amplitude is directly proportional, again, to the dynamics of the system as a function of time. So we're going to get this time series that will essentially read out what the asymmetric dynamics were doing as a function of time. And we can actually use this to peer into collapsing stars in a way that we'll never be able to do with light. So light is blocked by the outer layers of a collapsing star, for example, but we can see inside with gravitational waves, or we could also sense these dark objects, these black hole binaries, as they're merging together. All right, so why is the quadrupole moment the first contributing moment? This is a question that I usually get a lot. So we start here with this monopole moment. So we've got this mass energy density rho. If we integrate this together, we don't expect this to be changing for the system as a function of time. So if you can imagine some kind of asymmetric system, maybe a binary, we're not finding something that's varying. And then similarly, this dipole moment, so this is the center of mass. So now if you integrate this to find the center of mass, generally this is also not changing as a function of time. Finally, we get to the quadrupole moment. This is going to be the first contributing term that does change over time for systems with asymmetry. And so this is going to be a really powerful tool to probe if some systems do have asymmetry. So for example, one really interesting system is a neutron star. There's a lot that we don't know about the structure of hyperdense matter that's contained in neutron stars. However, if it can support some asymmetry, if that neutron star is spinning, then we should be able to see gravitational waves. And if we don't see gravitational waves from pulsars that we do see in our own galaxy, that's actually an interesting result for the structure of these objects.
All right. Use the distance from source, right?
Yes, yes, you're absolutely right. Let's walk a little bit more through this equation. So there are a few other things to notice. So this strain amplitude, first, immediately we get some intuition that this should be very small, because it's proportional to g and then divided by c to the fourth power. So immediately we know whatever's happening here, this number is going to be very small. And this builds our intuition that if we want this to be observable, where again, observable, we had a nice comment from the back of the room there, that means, you know, 10,000 times smaller than the diameter of a proton. That's observable. They're very, very tiny strains that we can see here on Earth. So this must be really, really big. There must be a lot of mass that's moving very quickly in order for this term to be large enough for us to sense this strain. And there's one more really important thing that I want you to notice here, which is that this amplitude is directly proportional to 1 over the distance, then you're exactly right. So this is the distance between the source and the observer. Yes?
If we're not in the weak field limit, does that work?
No, you're absolutely right. This is a weak field limit approximation, and it is going to work well for most purposes. And where it doesn't, we're going to need to use numerical relativity. Yes, excellent question. But I want to also point out, so if you're in the astronomy business or otherwise getting your signal using an area like a photodiode, you may be used to thinking about signal strength as going as 1 over r squared, an inverse square law dependency. What's really powerful about gravitational waves is that we have this description of strain amplitude. This is our signal amplitude that goes as 1 over r. And this is going to allow us to see vast, vast distances compared to electromagnetic astronomy with very good signal fidelity. Assuming we can overcome all these challenges that we foreshadowed we're going to talk about. Yes?
Excuse me, another question.
Sure.
It's 1 over r. How is this energy conserved? Like the flux, because you integrate over like the flux of the sphere r squared.
You can think about this as an analogy to electromagnetic astronomy. If we could measure the amplitude of the electric field, it would be essentially analogous, but we can't. Usually we measure the power. We need some kind of an area, and that gives us 1 over r squared. Yes?
So each object, that's supposed to be like a strain in like space-time, or?
Ah, yes. So we've got some nice gifts that we will get to build our intuition for what exactly do I mean when I say strain. But yes, so it's a two-dimensional, generally, space-time strain because we're going to see that we require two dimensions to fully describe it because it's a relative stretching and squeezing of space-time. But yes, we're going to measure it as change in length over length. So this is a dimensionless quantity that's telling you about stretching and squeezing. That's strain. That's also the same definition used in engineering if you've ever dabbled in engineering.
And just to get it straight, so this is like, you know, you have like some kind of like distribution of mass and energy over here, and then you're observing it over here, and it's causing strain over here as it kind of changes over. Like
exactly. Yes.
I just want to. It seems almost non-local in this form. Here. Is there some kind of way to account for like, you know, the delay between the two?
Ah, okay. Well, you can sort of think of gravitational wave detectors, especially ones that are not co-located. So let's say 2 Liger detectors and a Virgo detector, they're sort of like rubber ducks in a pond, and that pond is jostling all around with the sum of all of the gravitational waves that are propagating and that happen in the way they happen to add up at that point in time. So that gravitational wave detector is tracing out the sum of many, 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 many different gravitational wave sources. And most of them, the highest amplitude ones, are way too low in frequency for us to have any hope of seeing on Earth, but they're much, much louder than we've actually been sensing with LIGO and Virgo. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later. But yes, you're right. And as we heard from this part of the room, yes, there are many sources of gravitational waves moving through us at any moment of time, and it will be a really big challenge for analysis to sort them later on. Yeah, great question.
Maybe I comment on that, but I think the right-hand side is evaluated at a different time than the left-hand side.
Yes. So
the right-hand yes. side is okay. at a rotated time. So it's D minus R.
That's right. Exactly right. Yes, and that makes gravitational waves, although they're not affected by dust, which is a huge advantage in astrophysics. So there are a couple really big advantages. You can't see that they're not affected by dust from this equation, but what you'll talk about next week with Luis is how weakly interacting they are. So if we have a good model for what the system is doing and the time series that it should be producing in terms of strain local to the system, we can assume that we're essentially going to receive this crystal clear signature that's going to only have decayed by 1 over r, and that it's not going to have lost any of its time frequency morphology or been altered in transit by dust, by galaxies, by the Earth. We are going to see essentially this readout of the dynamics of the system. All we need to worry about is redshift and maybe lensing. Redshift and lensing. Yes, excellent point. Yeah, other questions, comments? All right, yeah, we've already gotten a lot from this first equation here. So I could tell you some fun facts about gravitational waves. I think it's more impactful for us to do some quick calculations ourselves. So let's get some practice here. So we've got a source, it's 5 billion light years away. What order of magnitude of the second time derivative of the quadrupole moment, what does that have to be in order to induce a local space-time strain on the order of 1 × 10^21, which is about the order of magnitude that LIGO and Virgo detect. So we've got some constants here. If you finish up a little bit earlier than the general chatter, then we can work on the units that might come in handy a little bit later on. All right, so let's find our team of 3 or 4, and let's spend 3 or 4 minutes calculating this out. H, yes, that's right. Strain, yes, length over length, that's right. How are we doing here? Very nice. Yeah. What have you come to an order of magnitude? It's a big number. Yeah. It's a really big number.
It's 11, huh?
All right, how are we doing here? Very nice.
I figure out what it is.
Yeah, fair enough.
The factors of one error, that's how we are.
Yeah, yeah, we try and steer clear of that in the experimental land. That's just such a nice statement, though. The factors of one are always complicated. Yes, I probably should have warned the group about that first. Sathya Prakash and Chetz, yes, those challenges are very present.
Well, I guess it's like
that's a big number, yeah?
Yeah.
No.
What I mean, just
yeah, very nice. Just how about you? How are you doing?
Yeah. I mean, you live in the
It's like 10 to the 31 or 32.
10 to the 48.
I got 31 or 32.
So what unit?
Yeah, which units are you using? Yeah, we might want to revisit that because we've yes.
It's like, you know, I can't do the calculations.
All right, how are we doing over here? Okay, what are your units? This is a highly, yes, unit-dependent question. So for example, I will give you, so the I've heard a lot from the side of the room about 10 of the 48 joules. That seems to be the consensus over here, depending on your, sorry? Thank you. Very precise. Yeah, just so we can have that calibration. All right, how are we doing here?
Yeah, I'm trying to make sense of what the units, like what they mean. So you get 10 to the 49-ish.
Yes.
So the units will be kilograms over length.
Yeah.
Cubes multiplied by length twice. Right. And then divided by time twice.
Yes. Yes, it's not a trivial set of algebra. But yes, your order of magnitudes agrees generally with this part of the room. Yeah.
Is this part of the room correct?
Yeah, that is pretty crazy. Yeah.
Wolfram's really good at the
order. Oh, I love the Wolfram effects.
Half the size of a hair. The amount of water inside of something like
Yeah, very nice. Well, I'll foreshadow that Lisa has sources that are, again, three or four orders of magnitude larger in amplitude.
Wow.
That's, yeah. Yeah. All right, everybody, it seems like some of us are converging. Would anybody like to share your approximation? Yes. Okay, very nice. This is a number that agrees with this side of the room. How about the units? What's our favorite unit for that?
Joules.
We had joules over here.
Yeah, joules, like a kilogram meter square per second. Yeah, that's good.
Okay, very good. So I heard some adjectives that I agree with. One was, that's crazy. Well, I suppose that's a phrase, not an adjective. Another was huge, which I also agree with. So yes, this gives us a sense of the scale. These are really, really enormous systems that are moving very fast. And we're going to see in just a little bit that as these black holes start to merge, they're whipping around each other at significant fractions of the speed of light. So you've got systems that are on the order of tens of times the mass of our sun, and then they're traveling extremely quickly. So this is the kind of scale of high energy that we're working with. Okay, so here's a thought exercise. So given our definition of quadrupole moments, so this is, again, this aspherical asymmetry condition, and the result of our last calculation, what astrophysical sources besides merging black holes, or you can include them if you like, what do you think could feasibly generate observable gravitational waves? Where again, here for LIGO Virgo, this is on the order of 10 to the minus 21 dimensionless strain, this change in a relative length of spacetime. And then let's also think about how your answer might change if the source is galactic. So here now we've got a very, very different number for R, this distance between the observer and the source. All right, so let's take another few minutes, see what we think. What kind of gravitational wave sources might we sense?
Just so.
so small, and they give us like such a
yes. No, actually, so they're all astrophysical. I might differentiate between somebody. So the next question that we're going to do together is, do we think that humans could make these? Which I would, that would be my definition of non-astrophysical. Yes. Yes, good question. Hi, what are we thinking here? Oh, you said colliding black holes?
Bubbles.
Colliding bubbles. Oh, okay. Well, this is interesting. What do we think might be in the bubbles? Ooh, okay. Colliding. Well, I mean, if the bubbles have enough mass and they're growing fast enough, yeah, we would see them. I think this is a really exciting thing about gravitational waves, is that if you can predict what that quadruple moment time derivative term is, then you can predict what the waveform would be, and you can search for it. And so we're doing this with cosmic strings and cosmic cusps and many other kind of weird phenomena.
What about things like earthquakes?
Like what? Oh, we worry about earthquakes all the time. Yes. They are... We can. Happily, our seismometers are much better ground motion detectors than our interferometer, which is the right way around. You always want that to be true. That means that your noise insulation is working well.
What if something happens in Mars?
What if something happens in what?
In Mars.
Oh, in Mars. Oh, that's an interesting question. So there are some theorists who are looking at shifts in, let's say if you've got two tectonic plates that weigh quite a lot and they shift. The order of magnitude, we should be able to sense it. However, due to how the light is resonating in the detectors and the control systems that keep that light resonant, we can't really sense DC, so a change where you go from one amplitude to the other. We really rely on oscillating sources in order for them to be detectable. That's right. So if Mars is also a little bit too far away for us to be able to see it.
If any, like, I don't know, fragmentation were to occur in black holes or stars or whatever, would you be able to see in the waveform?
No.
Fragment, okay, same.
Yes, and neutron stars, absolutely. So this is, when we wrote down this lambda parameter, this tidal deformability, that's essentially what we're describing.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. Yeah, really great. Nice thinking.
Whatever it is. I was gonna, sorry, your thing, you look for like cosmic streams, so that's not using this, like, Newtonian.
That's, yes, that's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. Yes, you would need some pretty serious general relativity. Yep. But we're also, we're pretty agnostic. We don't have a waveform for cosmic strings the way that we do a complex binary, where you can use this really accurate point source approximation in the weak field limit. We just look for something bursting. And then maybe it's a cosmic cusp, maybe it's a supernova, maybe it's a cosmic string.
What do you mean something bursting?
Ah, so this is what we use to describe a generic gravitational wave source that is transient in time. We call them bursts.
So what would that look like?
It could look like anything. All we require is that the signal is coherent across detectors, and so that it can be captured well with wavelets, because if it's not, then we won't find it. But that's the only constraint. And you can think about merging black holes as a form of bursts. We also see them with our burst searches. Yeah. All right, how are we doing back here?
Yeah, I mean, I know neutron star mergers also do like detectable gravitational waves, but I don't know how to get like the factor, like that R factor from that physical process.
Well, it means that we can see much, much quieter sources. One of them we've discussed a little bit, which is neutron stars. So you mentioned this. I assume that you meant merging neutron stars.
Yeah.
But rotating neutron stars, yes, we can only see those in our galaxy. They're too quiet otherwise.
Right, exactly.
Yes, actually, that was, okay, that's what you meant. You're already there.
And that was my, comes to like a second question I had.
Yeah.
In terms of like galactic sources, let's say Andromeda galaxy.
Yeah.
To detect, I guess, gravitational waves coming from the Andromeda galaxy, how is that possible? Like, wouldn't it be too damped by the time that comes?
So there's not much that damps a gravitational wave. It's just the 1/r decay. That's it. I mean, it, as it interacts with matter, it transfers a little bit of energy, which is the reason we can see them. A little bit, but the effect is so small, there's so little energy lost, that there's no way that we could detect a dampening effect. It's negligible for our purposes.
Oh, even with like ordinary matter?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What about like galaxy collision? Like, does that, can, I mean, of course generate gravitational waves, but how strong?
Very strong. Yeah. So this is one of the most important sources for LISA.
Oh, okay.
Yes, and it's actually, so this is something that we'll talk about a little bit later, but LISA sources, those supermassive black holes, are multiple orders of magnitude stronger in amplitude than what we see with LIGO. They're very, very, very strong.
But, so, like, that's for black holes, right?
Yes.
For, like, the entire galaxy. Like,
oh, the galaxy yeah. is too dispersed.
Yeah,
yeah. You need a very well-localized...
Like,
oh, okay.
Stuff do not collide.
Exactly. Yeah, you need it to be extremely well localized to see a resolvable signature. Yeah.
So like no galaxy wave, sorry, no gravitational waves from bulk clusters or stuff like that.
That's right. Yeah, the sort of most tangential idea that we've had is searching for exotic dark matter that clumps up around a black hole in an interesting way. That's something that we look for.
I remember like a really old paper by Weinberg where he was trying to see if gravitational waves passing through some dark matter medium actually like does some phase shift that can be detected.
Yeah.
And from what I understand, it was not possible. But he put bounds. It's not like he just said like it's not possible. He actually had some really bounds. It's really sensitive.
Yep.
Is that like something in the hope for the future where we can have like sensitive instrumentation? Or?
Phase shifts are really tough when you're using interferometers. It's very tough for us to see DC effects, so changes in gravitational memory, phase shifts, that where you go from one amplitude to another, it's really tough for us to resolve those. LISA will have a better shot at it though, because it's much lower frequency. LIGO has no hope of seeing DC effects. All right, great questions. I think I hear the chatter dying down, so I'll rally us. All right, everybody. I've heard some really great ideas over here on this side of the room. Does anybody want to share, what are we thinking for sources?
The typical length scale, by length I cannot mention, meter, is mm-hmm. 10 to the power minus 63, right? That dimension full parameter, HIJ equals...
Oh, the strain?
Yeah.
Yep, so here, our definition of observable, we're calibrating to LIGO Virgo. This won't be the same order of magnitude of strain for LISA. LISA will require gravitational waves to actually be orders of magnitude stronger in amplitude, but we're calibrating to 10 to the minus 21 here, the ground-based regime. All right, I heard some great
mergers
answers from
things.
Over here. Sorry?
Mergers of things.
Mergers of things.
Like holes, neutron stars.
Yes, and you've listed two particular types of objects, and I wonder if we can characterize those together. What makes those a class of object?
Compact.
Compact. Yes. Yes. Does anybody have a sense or some intuition for why they need to be compact? This is something you'll talk more about next week, and we can also do an exercise on it together. Yes?
Well, it's like density. Okay. You need a quadrupole moment, so it needs to be varying over like, you know, small distances as well. So it's like, you know, you need very massive objects in order to create that, like, you know, this differential. And it's like, you know, not only that, it's like, you know, it needs to be a quadrupole moment. So it's like, you know, you need to be able to bring these things close together, because if you bring, like, you know, galaxies are massive, but you can't create a large differential with two galaxies. So
Yes, you said something very important here that I want to highlight. So we need to bring these things close together. So for the frequency range of LIGO Virgo, which we haven't gotten to yet, but we will. So we're looking at hundreds of hertz. And that gives you a sense of how quickly those two objects are orbiting around each other. And in order for them to be orbiting that quickly, they have to be close together. They must be compact. So for example, we'll never see the merger of two white dwarfs because that distance is actually smaller than the radius of the star. So yes, excellent. Very nice.
Quick is important, or how they accelerate. Because they accelerate too.
Yes.
Because if it's rotational, it does accelerate.
Yes, the frequency is important for our discussion here because of the interferometers that we're using. So ground base has no hope of sensing low frequency sources. We'll talk about why a little bit later. But we're really limited to the high frequency regime, so they have to be orbiting really fast. So that totally rules out anything that's not compact. Okay, excellent. Yeah, I heard some. Oh, we have a.
If it's galactic, then mountains are neutron star.
Yes, neutron star. We'll call them mountains. All right, very nice. What else do we think?
Black holes.
I'm gonna classify black holes in this compact. They're the most compactest. We'll put them in this category, but yes, excellent, black holes.
Vacuum phase transitions.
Okay, potentially phase transitions.
Cosmic strings.
Yes. We actually do search for cosmic strings, yes. Cosmic strings.
Is it clear?
Well, we'll find out, won't we? Yes.
Can a supernova cause black?
So a certain type of supernova we do think would generate enough of an asymmetric acceleration. And it's not a type 1a supernova, it's actually core collapse. Core collapse supernova.
White dwarfs.
White dwarfs, this is true. And in what frequency regime is this true? White dwarfs, we know that we can't see them at the higher frequencies. Lower frequencies, so this is going to be Lisa's source, white dwarfs. And we're actually going to see many, many, many thousands of them with Lisa.
What about Big Bang?
Sorry, can you say that one more time?
Big Bang. Early universe.
The Big Bang, yes. Okay, so some kind of stochastic background. So this might come from a couple different sources. So it could come from the Big Bang. It could also come from this irresolvable popcorn of many, many different mergers of compact things. So I'll write down stochastic. Okay, very nice. Yes?
Just really fast moving objects produce, not necessarily a collision or emerging, just imagine a very advanced civilization which is linearly accelerating a star. Can that produce two gravitational waves?
It would be tough for us to, with a linear acceleration for that, if it's especially a spherically symmetric object, for that to produce an observable gravitational wave. However, there have been some really interesting papers about scattering interactions, and I think I heard somebody mention this towards the back of the room here, but you could have a very quick interaction between two compact objects that would be a very quick burst of gravitational waves. So we'll say maybe scattering. Okay, very nice, yeah.
We were also discussing if galaxies can generate, I don't know, maybe colliding or something.
We were having a similar discussion in the back corner of the room over here. So there is a part of a galaxy that when it encounters its counterpart in the other galaxy will produce a massive gravitational wave signal. Can we guess what that is? It's very, very, very massive, highly compact. Yes, the supermassive black holes. And this is a really interesting LISA source because we can electromagnetically observe galaxy mergers that are going to be in the range of LISA. So we'll be able to watch those supermassive black holes orbiting each other before they collide, yes, with LISA. But I'm also going to file those, I think, in the mergers of compact objects. But LISA's going to be able to sense them far, far before they actually merge, whereas LIGO and Virgo are really only seeing the last seconds. Yes?
So this is like if an object has spherical asymmetry but it's not moving, I don't know, does that generate anything? I'm not sure.
Yes, well, let's consider that. So yes, so generally we require the time evolution. That's it's the second time derivative of the quadrupole moment that's going to generate this this strain. But that's a great question.
What about inflation? Like we already mentioned cosmic things like Big Bang, but inflation is changing the metric in a really fast way.
Right.
Produce gravitational waves.
It depends on, well, I will rely on the quantum gravity theorists, I think, to speculate on what kind of distortions might have been present at the time of inflation and how that may have generated or contributed to the stochastic background that we are searching for. What's really tough about the very early universe for us is that gravitational waves are subject to redshift. So by the time that we sense them, they're very, very, very low frequency indeed, far lower even than pulsar timing can sense right now. So this is, we're talking like bicep keck, which I have very little prepared for at the moment. But yeah, that's a great question. Yes?
Yeah, one thing is all of this simple relation come from the Wigfield linear model. Do I expect a like, drastic change if I go... I mean, because the mergers are really strong and the field is really strong and we need at the end the numerical relativity for them. So that simple relation changes when we actually consider that.
Yes, you're right. So we're actually going to have to throw out this approach entirely when those black holes start to approach each other. So when we're in the strong field limit, and this is also as they start to approach the speed of light. So we're going to see concretely where the regime is, where we go from a point source approximation, where the weak field limit assumptions that we're making are valid, and where we really require numerical relativity, which is close to the merger phase.
I'm asking this order of magnitude calculation.
Oh, the order of magnitude. Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes, that's right. This is going to give us a very good intuition for the rough order of magnitude of these sources. So for example, for compact object mergers, at least in the lower mass regime, most of the signal-to-noise ratio, most of the power in the gravitational wave source is going to be in the in-spiral phase. So we can approximate that very well. Yes, great question. Yes?
I read about this a long time ago. I don't know like the validity of gravity balls.
Oh, so this is similar to, so you said gravity balls with a B?
Yeah, gravity balls, yeah.
Yes, so this is similar to an idea I thought was really neat up here about bubbles. And I think, you know, it depends on whatever you put in the bubble or the ball. But we could conceive of something, right, that's very compact, that's very dense. It doesn't have to be a black hole or a neutron star. It could be some exotic compact object that we haven't conceived of yet. So, yeah, I think future observations with more signal fidelity may allow us to resolve this, to disentangle between these exotic objects. Yeah, great question. Yes?
Could objects or like debris being accelerated in accretion disks generate gravitational waves?
So this is a really good question. Potentially, and it's a really interesting topic for astronomers who are actually following up looking for electromagnetic counterparts to binary black hole mergers, thinking about accretion disks. So it's an interesting perspective multi-messenger source. It's tough for debris to generate a gravitation wave signal, similar, we were talking about galaxies themselves, the gas and the dust and whatnot, that's too diffuse. But if you have some elements of the accretion disk, so for example, the collaboration has done a search for a perspective type of dark matter that could conceivably be accreting around a black hole that might achieve the kind of densities required for us to get an observable signal, potentially. Yeah, great question. All right, so let's forge ahead here. We've got a fearsome list of sources, and let's give ourselves a challenge. So let's maybe just discuss with the room here. Do we think, with this in mind, that it's currently possible for humans to generate observable gravitational waves?
Even if you move at the speed of light, the mass is not enough.
That's right. So I often get the question, if I'm talking to a reporter, well, what's the application? Could we use this for communication? Could we make a weapon?
Yes.
So yes,
Yeah.
Very much. That's very much a no at present. Yeah, I think it. But it's also nice to think about that we do have the capacity to generate gravitational waves. We just can't sense them. As I'm gesticulating at you wildly, I'm making many gravitational waves. All right. Now here is a really important point. So if we think we have a very good model for how this quadrupole moment is changing over time, can we infer the distance, r, directly from our measured strain? And why or why not? Let's take a few minutes and see what we think about that.
When you say a very good model for this quadrupole moment,
yes.
What inputs do we have?
Let's say that I've used general relativity to capture completely the time frequency morphology of the signal of two black holes merging.
Yeah.
And I have a perfect model.
But it can always rescale the mass of the two black holes.
So let's say I know the mass of the two black holes. I have perfect knowledge of the source.
Yeah.
So there's a key point here that I think you're getting at, which is that So the masses are going to change the shape of the source. So I can infer the masses from the morphology of the source. And once I know that, we can do better with a higher signal fidelity.
Deduce the distribution, right? But then it's like, how do you deal with issues like dark matter and like whatever? It's just like
it won't become two unknown variable one equation if we infer from the equation itself.
Well, so there's a really cool element here that we will discuss a little bit later in more detail, but the evolution of the signal, the time frequency morphology, is giving you the masses. And if you know the masses, you know the amplitude at the source.
It is not necessary to indirectly measure our using optics, I don't know, observation optics.
Mm-hmm.
And from using that R, then we infer that we have such a strength.
The other
because
way around.
Yeah.
You observe the strength, can you infer R?
Yes. So R is the golden inference, right? Because it's such a huge problem in astronomy to know distances. Knowing, being able to directly infer R is incredibly powerful. I think it's possible. Well, I'll give you a hint that we do think it's possible.
I feel like it requires, like, you know, my thoughts right now is that it requires, well, but, you know, the frequency will be clear, like, you know, changing, like, you know, assuming that it's a periodic thing, then
right.
The frequency will be, like, you know, because it'll be the same,
yes.
And you observe it, like, you know, the signal will all the same frequency, so that's not a problem, but the mass distribution, can we really, it's like, I feel like that's just the last piece of the puzzle, and we'll then find the distance, because then, like, you need to be able to reliably find the density, and then from there, then you can quadrupole moment over time.
So let's assume that at least within the LIGO-Virgo frequency range that we can have a unique mapping between a particular time frequency morphology of a signal and a mass and a spin. So we'll be able to directly infer just from the shape of the signal, how it's changing over time, what the masses are, and some other properties.
Just from the signal.
Yep.
So no looking at the sky.
Yep.
That's
right. The one thing we do need to assume, though, is cosmology, because that mass is going to be redshifted. Yes, that's the sticker.
Oh. Okay, that's very interesting.
How are we doing here? How are we doing here?
Good. I think the question is, having a good model mean you can actually infer the absolute scale of what's happening, or does it just mean you can understand, like, the, you know, the, I don't know, the geometry or the time evolution?
Assume that we have a very good knowledge of the pattern and geometry. Well, by that I assume you mean the time frequency morphology of the signal, and that maps uniquely and directly onto a particular set of masses, which tells us the amplitude at the origin of the source.
Okay.
Let's assume that that's true.
In that case, then I mean, then it seems like you can infer the distance.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
We agree.
Okay, good.
Okay. Yes. Very nice. Yes.
We're not sure what you mean by model.
A very good model.
Okay, so let's assume that we have a way to perfectly capture the time frequency evolution of the signal. And yes, so general relativity will allow us to map that time frequency evolution fairly uniquely onto the masses. And once we know the masses, we know the amplitude at the source.
Okay. So we can get
yes. I think
if
so.
If we have a very good model.
If we have a very good model.
Like usually.
It's usually the signal's a little bit fuzzy. There's some degeneracy between the amplitude, so the orientation of the source also plays a role. So let's say the source is orbiting this way and we're sort of over here, that's going to be a lower amplitude signal. So having some multi-messenger knowledge, for example, of a binary neutron star, what way the gamma ray burst jet is coming, helps us infer the distance. So it's not perfect knowledge.
So based on the frequency of the wave you get.
Yes, and how that frequency is changing over time in particular.
Over time.
Yes, F dot, that's the key.
So Hij is usually a measured quantity here on Earth.
Yes.
And what we look for, like if we know R, we get the other thing, and if we know the other thing, we get R. Is that what, like, what's useful about this?
That's right.
Like to determine distances to objects that we got a signal from, kind of?
When they are getting closer to each other, they should send high frequency, and they are getting away, it goes to larger.
That's right. And they'll only ever go in one direction, because they're losing energy to gravitational radiation, so they're only ever going to spin towards each other.
Yeah.
All right, yeah.
At the end,
nice discussion.
Bill, at the end, we get R in the cosmological.
That's right.
We need a signal at source, perfectly, for the model. Rather, we don't know what happened.
And you're right. We do need to assume some cosmological model, because those masses are going to be redshifted. So we usually assume lambda CDM. Yeah, excellent point. All right, seems like we're converging. All right, so what are we thinking? Can we infer the distance? We had a lot of really good discussion on this side of the room about what it means exactly to have a very good model, if people have thoughts on that they want to share. But what do we think? Are we going to be able to infer the distance to the source if we're able to capture the morphology of the source in our detectors? I heard a yes. I agree with that. So this is before we get into why, and I would love to hear more answers about why we think that's true, but I really want to emphasize that this is a unique and very powerful capability for gravitational waves. So this is a huge problem in astrophysics and cosmology, is measuring distance, because you have all of these different, often uncertainly calibrated standard candles by the time you get out to type 1a supernovae for the most distant measurements. So gravitational waves can reach that distance, the same distance scale as type 1a supernovae, yes?
What kind of distance we're talking about?
Gigaparsecs. A redshift of 1 or 2. Oh. So far. We'll be able to go farther with gravitational waves. Yes?
My colleagues actually, they raised another related question. So is this luminosity distance, or is it angular diameter distance in cosmology? Is it matter?
Yes. Well, usually we when we report a distance, you'll see in a collaboration paper the luminosity distance. And I think that's getting at some of these other subtleties, and with a lot of good discussion I was hearing, especially I was mostly over here listening to very good discussions there about, again, what does it mean to have a very good model? And thinking about cosmology, for example, is one of the things that we include in that very good model. But I'll summarize some of the discussions we had over here. So let's say that we have a perfect measurement of how our system is evolving in time. So we know the shape of the time frequency morphology of the signal. GR will allow us to fairly uniquely, so there are some subtleties, some other ways that the signal can change, but fairly uniquely map that directly to the masses of the system. Once we know the masses, we know the amplitude at the source. Once we have the amplitude at the source, we can directly infer that distance. But those masses are going to be redshifted. The frequency is going to be redshifted by the time it gets to us, that morphology. So we have to assume some cosmological model in order to produce this luminosity distance that we report. All right.
So does this estimate include expansion of the universe? I assume it didn't include it. But
it does. That's right.
Okay. So it is luminosity distance.
That's right. Yes, great question. Yes?
These are in basic GR, we know that it cannot be exactly the physical distance. In flat space time, it is physical distance, but near the black hole, in the first approximation, the physical distance would be root the square of G00 times R, or the other way around. Have we taken into account that?
So our error bars, you know, we have a direct measurement that does not require other calibrations. We call this the standard siren. However, our error bars are very big. So we're not at the point yet where we need to worry about that level of detail. And in fact, we rely on astronomers to localize these sources to a host galaxy. So even if you match a gravitational wave inference of distance to a known redshift from a host galaxy, there's still fuzz in terms of what exactly the distance is.
So kind of R is effective distance, right?
You could think about it that way, effective luminosity distance. Yes?
So the reported masses for a particular event, are those real masses or redshifted masses?
It depends. So you should watch for the label on the paper if it says source mass or MZ. And that they should, there's some degeneracy there. They should specify which ones.
I mean, is there any way that they get actual masses or?
Yes, you can infer the source mass if you assume some cosmological model. Often we do report the source mass, and that's what we mean is the mass as it would appear at the source, not as it's observed.
But people usually say for gravitational wave observations, we have luminosity distance, but we don't have redshift. But if you assume a cosmological model to infer the mass, then you have the model, and then you have luminosity distance, so you have the redshift also.
That's an interesting point. Yes, so right now we're operating at low enough redshifts that we don't need to worry too much about this problem. But yes, if we're beyond the 40 megaparsecs of the first multi-messenger detection, so this is the first time that we applied the gravitational wave inferred distance with some measured redshift from electromagnetic astronomy. So this is the kilonova from the neutron star merger. So at that distance, we haven't quite reached the Hubble flow yet, so this wasn't an issue for us. Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think I'd have to look back at the statistical cosmology paper. So there's an effort within the collaboration that looks at galaxy catalogs and measurements of redshifts within galaxy catalogs, and then the uncertainty distance measurements from gravitational waves to stitch this together. And I don't know if they've limited themselves to the local universe for that reason. I'll have to check that out. Yeah, it's a good point. Yes?
So about the contribution from the quadrupoles, how about the higher order contribution? Are they too small, like octopole, that we can neglect? Or?
That is such a wonderful question. So yes, there are higher order modes. So something that I should have emphasized is that the approximation that we're looking at, so this is the first order contribution, and it is dominant. So we're currently not at the sensitivity. We don't have enough signal fidelity to resolve higher order modes. We have evidence that one signal so far may have had some of these higher harmonics in it, but not enough for us to regularly use them to break degeneracies between spins and total mass, for example.
In order of number, what's the relative like order between the first order and second order?
I would say, so I think about things in terms of signal-to-noise ratio. I would say if I have a signal-to-noise ratio, a total SNR signal of, let's say, 30, then these higher order modes would be less than a 10% effect, less than 10% of the SNR. Yeah, great question. All right. Yeah, very nice discussion. Yes?
Maybe I misunderstood, but the way I thought about the advantage of gravitational waves was that you could get a physical distance directly. But then to convert that into a luminosity distance or a redshift, you need to assume a cosmological model. But it seems like that's not exactly what you get the like R is the luminosity distance, or?
Well, the cosmology that we assume actually comes into that we assume that the frequency of the signal has been redshifted, so that we think about that as mass redshift. So it's the evolution of the signal itself that we're using to infer the masses, which will give us the amplitude at the source, which will give us the distance. That's the stage that the cosmology comes into. As we correct the masses to be the source mass, then you get the source amplitude, then you can infer the distance. Yeah, good question. All right, so let's see here. We've got about 10 more minutes. All right, and we have actually really nicely derived the kinds of signals that we look for and the kinds of challenges that we face with these different types of signals. So I've broken this up into how well we're able to model a source. So everything that you see here in green, these are all of our mergers, our compact object mergers, not including scattering yet. We have observed most of them already, a binary neutron star, a binary black hole, an intermediate mass black hole, depending on how you're defining intermediate mass. This is an argument we get a lot into with astronomers. So this is about 120 total solar masses. And then we also have this prospect of eccentric binary systems. So one of the reasons we think that this is rare is that you have a system, if it starts with some eccentricity, as it emits gravitational waves, that's going to tend to circularize the binary over time. So we expect the vast majority of our signals to be fairly circular and non-eccentric, because eccentricity is going to introduce this beat note, this bursting behavior that you see here relative to these other sources. So we haven't seen these yet, but we expect that if the black holes are dynamically captured, or there's some kind of exotic three-body interaction going on, it's possible that we may see these, and that would be a smoking gun for this dynamical formation channel, which we will talk a little bit more about in a little while. We've also got, we talked a little bit about bursts up here in this corner. So one of the example of a generic burst of gravitational waves where we make no assumption whatsoever about its form when we're looking for it is this core collapse supernovae that we talked about. Also cosmic cusps, cosmic strings, we will also search for using this burst search. We have not found any burst-like sources yet. And then over here on the x-axis, so this is the duration of the signal that we could potentially measure in the band of LIGO-Virgo detectors, so the ground-based astronomy. So we'll only ever see very short durations for most of these transient signals. So these are the compact object mergers, the supernova. Neutron stars are actually high enough in frequency that we, when we build bigger detectors, we might actually start to see those for days, maybe even weeks. But for now, it's still on the order of tens of seconds. But all the way over on the other side here, so the stochastic background, whether that's coming from the Big Bang or it's coming from this irresolvable popcorn effect of lots and lots of different mergers, we expect this to be going on for a very long time. So here we like to integrate lots and lots of data, many different observing runs, as much time as we can. Similarly with continuous waves, so these are our spinning neutron star mountains, and we'll spend a little bit of time talking about those sources too. All right, so in our last 10 minutes before coffee here, we're gonna break down what we know. We're gonna talk about compact binary coalescences, supernovae, and then also these continuous waves, so the spinning neutron stars, and just build up a little bit more of an intuition for these models. So we've said if we have a good model, if we have a very well understood model for a source, and we're able to extract a good measurement from our data, we can do really powerful things like inferring the distance. So we are here still in our far field limit, generally, which is going to describe most of the signal. And when I say most of, I mean that in a signal-to-noise ratio sense, what's going to dominate the power that's in our data. So especially for lower mass sources, where by lower mass here I mean below about 50 total solar masses or so, this in-spiral phase is going to dominate, where we can treat those black holes or neutron stars as point sources and use the approximation that we were using before. So if we make this approximation, the frequency evolution, so this is how the frequency of the source itself is changing, how this frequency is evolving over time. So this is given to us by this post-Newtonian approximation, which depends on this really funny term that you may have heard of called the chirp mass. And this is what governs this change in frequency and why we so often refer to this in gravitational wave astronomy is because the chirp mass is what's dominating how the source is changing in time before it starts to merge. So it's this funny combination of the product of the two masses. So M1 we usually define to be the heavier of the two component masses that are going to merge together. M2 arbitrarily we usually call the secondary or the lighter, the less massive of the two. And then here is this total mass, which you often may also see written as a capital M with a subscript capital T. That MT usually means total mass, which is going to dominate how signals at the high mass end of the mass regime will evolve in frequency. But let's just get a little bit of a physical intuition here. We've got two different segments of this plot. So this is the strain amplitude over time. This is our signal model. This is the space-time strain we expect the source to emit and the waveform that we expect to be able to recover from our detector data if we have high enough signal fidelity. And we've got two different regimes here. So one is where the black holes are well separated and have, well, a relatively low velocity. You'll know that we start here at 30% of the speed of light in this plot, so not exactly low. But as the black holes get closer together, as they start to speed up closer and closer to the speed of light, we change from being able to use this far field approximation to requiring numerical relativity. So as the black holes get close enough together, as they start to merge, we're going to need to do something more complicated. But it's generally, for lower mass sources, a small enough fraction of the overall source that we can still get a very good measurement, even if we only use this to model the end spiral of our sources. That model is going to be good enough for us to identify essentially nearly all of our lower mass sources. All right, so one more thing for me to point out here is that we usually talk about three different phases of a compact object merger. One is this in spiral phase, so that's where this approximation is valid, and this F dot term is going to be dominated by the chirp mass, and we can treat them like point sources. Here's the merger where we first start to need numerical relativity. This doesn't mean that the objects are necessarily touching each other yet. It just means that we're now in the strong fields regime and we require general relativity to accurately describe the source. And then finally, this final object, generally a black hole, is going to ring down like a bell. And there's a lot of interesting information in that too in terms of testing the Noether theorem that Luis knows way more about than I do, but that's another really rich source of potential fundamental physics investigations. All right, any questions about the simple model for compact binary coalescences? Yes?
Yeah, there are also black hole neutron science variables, right? Not only black hole, black hole.
That's right, yes. So there are black hole, black holes, black holes, neutron stars, neutron star, neutron star. In terms of what we are able to see from gravitational waves, we can only tell the mass from this term. So this time frequency evolution up to the, including the in spiral phase, will only ever tell us the masses. So they could be a really weird, great big neutron star. It could be some exotic object made of quarks. We can't tell from this term. We need to look closer, especially at this part right here, because if it has matter in it, and we'll be able to see this with tidal deformability. I forget who asked about this, but we're going to talk a little bit about how that will change the shape of the signal in a way that we can start to infer the composition of what the sources are. All right, excellent question. Yes, other questions? Yes?
I think a couple of years earlier, I saw a paper just doing basic signal analysis and orders of magnitude, that they were talking specifically about the Loud event in 2015, that they could somehow estimate the compactness of the objects, and they could infer that they are black holes for sure. Don't know how accurate that is, or I mean, just without talking about waveforms or NR, just using the chirp frequency and chirp mass. Or maybe because that event was loud enough that they could talk about these things. I don't know.
Yeah, that's an interesting.
Yeah, because I was wondering, I mean, how can we infer that they are, I mean, black holes? And if you trust the astrophysics, that with that compactness, they should have collapsed to a form of black hole, then they were inferring something like that. It was a,
Oh, I see. So they were taking something like the separation and saying, well, it would have to be a black hole in order to be this close. Okay, well, we could do that. That's certainly true. It will require, though, more signal fidelity than we had in the very first detection in order to really be sure that there aren't deformability effects. Yes?
We usually see in papers they report M1 and M2 separately. With this sims, we only can observe MC achievement.
Ah, yes. So this is the dominant term, and this is going to govern most of what we see about the N-spiral. We are going to get to other effects like spin and also mass ratio, which are going to also evolve the phase of the signal. Well, I think I have this after the coffee break, but we're going to get a little bit of practice with how those imprint a signature on this phase evolution also. Those are second order effects, though. This is the first order governing term. But excellent question. Yes?
I know they are like doing this movement, so there's an acceleration, but how relevant is just to use a first derivative of the frequency when the power comes from a second derivative of this variable moment?
So we're thinking like experimentalists now, where we're most interested in how easy it's going to be for us to extract the physics from the data. So here, what's going to be the most powerful for us to do in a data analysis signal processing sense is to look for how this is changing in frequency. So we'll see some spectrograms in a little while. If you even just whiten the data simply and make a spectrogram of it, you can see how the source is evolving in frequency. So that's a very straightforward thing for us to draw from the data. So we're essentially trying to do the simplest possible mapping of what we're seeing in the data to the physics. But yeah, great question.
Can I add a comment, actually?
Yes, please.
I think also it needs us that we are somehow assuming a balance law, that the system, they are in spiraling, but they are losing energy, and the same amount of energy that the system is losing is the same amount that is being radiated as gravitational wave, and that is proportional to F dot.
Yes, that's actually a very good point that's going to come up later in one of our thought exercises, so hold on to that, everybody. And I see we just have a couple more minutes left, and there is some thinking I wanted us to do. So let's maybe end here, and then we'll pick back up with continuous waves and bursts before we jump to the next topic. For us, this isn't so much of a review as a series of very fun facts. So we can derive, and you may actually work through this derivation with Luis next week. So this is a very simple estimate of the strain amplitude if you have two black holes. So you can approximate the strain amplitude as the radius, the Schwarzschild radius of each one of the two compact objects. So generally, this is most useful for us in the case of black holes. Divided by the distance between the observer and the source, and then also this distance between the black holes. This is what this little r means. So RS1 is the Schwarzschild radius of the first black hole. Similarly for the second black hole, little r is the distance between the center of mass of the two black holes, and big R is the distance between you, the observer, and the source. And we can also from this estimate the luminosity emitted by these CBC sources. So this is going to be a function of their total mass. So this is the sum of the two component masses, and then also a function of, again, the distance between us, the observer, and our source. So one remarkable thing is that near merger, so this is a very fast effect. So this is happening with on the order of tens of milliseconds for black hole sources, 5% of their total rest mass energy. So this is the total of the total mass. Is going to be emitted in gravitational waves. So let's see. What do you think? Do we have time to do one thought exercise together? A couple quick calculations before coffee? Okay. How do we feel about that? We want to do a little bit more calculating before coffee? Are we feeling like we need caffeine? Yes. Okay. I see a thumbs up. So we're going to go for it. So we can calculate this energy. I think I might try and skip us. Yeah, so I think this is going to be a lot more fun. So here's the approximation that we just learned. So let's approximate the luminosity of a system that has a 70 solar mass black hole, a 50 solar mass black hole with a 10 radius of 10 Schwarzschild radius separation. Oh, I'd meant to keep them the same. Sorry about that. Let's make this 60 solar mass, 60 solar mass, so that they both have the same Schwarzschild radius. That'll make it a little easier. So compare your answer when you finally get the number with the following sources. So we've got a supernova, we've got an AGN, and then we've got the total visible light of all of the galaxies in the observable universe. And let's see which one is bigger. So let's just take a few more minutes and we'll work on that before coffee. Hi.
No, I was just wondering, does it matter if the two sources have different masses or?
I think it's going to be an easier calculation if we make them the same. So it's the total mass that matters, so I suggest just making them both 60. Yes, I was changing this last night because I thought it would be fun, and it was like 1 in the morning and I didn't think this through, so here we are.
It only depends on the material. Why does it matter how you determine it?
I guess I know.
So the reason that I think that this would be easier is because I gave the separation in terms of the Schwarzschild radius, which is going to feed into big R.
And we'd have to know which one you know, which
yes, exactly. So, yep. That's yeah, I didn't catch that at 1 in the morning either.
One is...
Oh man, are you already finished?
No, I was just doing the simpler calculation.
Okay, gotcha. It looks in the right ballpark.
Yeah.
It's a lot of energy.
It's, yeah. Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. So CBC is a compact binary coalescence. So it's the merger of two compact objects.
By luminosity, you mean some sort of energy per...
Power over time. Yep. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Is it directly related to age, or?
Well, when you say, so did you say age?
Yeah, no, it's rate. Right. I'm not sure how you quantify energy as well.
Ah, that's what you meant about area. Yes, that's right. So if you integrated the energy passing through a surface over time, yes, that's right.
What kind of energy?
Gravitational wave energy.
So
you can think about it maybe in terms of subtraction. So the binary system has some rotational energy as it's orbiting, and that energy, part of that energy, is being radiated away in the form of gravitational waves. So I like to think about it sometimes as a subtraction. So the energy that's being radiated, you can calculate directly from the energy that must be remaining in the system as the frequency is evolving higher and higher. We can think about it that way.
Last question, there should be a theoretical relation between age and luminosity.
So when you say age, you mean the time remaining until merger?
No, the strain, H-I-J.
Oh, H, okay. Got it. And then I've lost track of the rest of your question. So strain and...
Luminosity should be dependent.
So we can take them to the 52 and a bunch of... And then here
that's right. So the if we think about... If we think about strain as the amplitude of our signal, then that's right. So the energy is going to be related to how that amplitude is changing, and the luminosity, we're going to see how that's evolving over time. That's right.
Yeah.
I
know.
Is it a simple relation, or it's
kind of... I'm sure that Luis is going to go over this. or at least, well, maybe I'm not sure. I haven't talked to him about it yet, but yeah, I would expect you guys to be breaking that down next week. Yeah, good questions. How are you doing?
Well, I'm falling into love with gravitational waves.
Well, they're pretty great, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah. Your previous presentation, that was pretty influential. Another talk by Nian Yang. Do you know him?
Yes, I do. I'm expecting him at any moment to pop in here and talk about mystery noise.
He's working on a stochastic gravitational wave. Mm-hmm. In this lecture. Probably with that gravitational.
Amazing. Very nice. Yes.
The power, how long does it last? Like, how much energy? Or is it just 5% of the mc squared?
How much energy? Yes. So, well, it can't last at this luminosity for very long. So, yeah, I'll give you the number for two of the most famous black holes that we have seen colliding. So that was a 29 and 36 solar mass black hole. Yes, that's right, well remembered. So that was 3 solar masses radiated, and that's just in the 10 milliseconds that we could see the signal in the detectors. Yeah, isn't that wild?
Yeah, you don't really multiply M by 2 squared that often in the universe. But.
Isn't that wild? Yeah.
You sound like you're a fortress house.
Yes. Yeah, it both feels very natural to me when I think about, okay, I've got great big black holes, they're whooping around each other at, 60% of the speed of light, of course, it's a huge amount of energy that's going to be emitted, but, seeing it in the context of all of the visible light that we could possibly see, yeah, it's... All right, everybody, I see some numbers have appeared, and I want to save a little bit of time for caffeine and recuperating. I think we have another lecture, and then we'll see each other again after lunch, which will give me a little bit of time to cater a bit towards more of what we want to see. But does anybody want to share the number that you got? Yes?
9 × 10⁻³ watts.
Wow. Yeah. Well, I think we have a slight difference in order of magnitude here.
I got 64 point, well, I guess it'll be 6.48 × 10⁻³ watts.
Okay, I think I see some answers in the front row that more match my calculations.
Yeah, 10⁻⁵ watts.
Yes, 10⁻⁵, I hear a yes up there. Not a trivial 48, okay, 49. So we've made some different approximations here. But I'll tell you, so there's a fun fact that we like to share about the very first detection and all subsequent black hole mergers, is that very briefly, they will outshine in luminosity all of the visible lights, all of the AGN, all of the galaxies in the universe for that moment, that 10 milliseconds. All right, so I'll leave you there. That's a good note to end on for coffee.